Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Nonviolent direct action spread across the South during the early 60s civil rights movement, starting with a sit-in at the Woolworth lunch counter where four black college students requested service and were denied, demanding equal treatment. Peaceful sit-ins and demonstrations met by violent white extremists would propel the civil rights movement into the national public spotlight. Meanwhile, a different civil rights movement was forming in Oakland, California, setting out to meet the needs and confront the challenges urban blacks were facing. In 1966, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale founded the Black Panther Party. They created a 10-point program outlining the party's goals. Platform 1 stated, "We want freedom. We want power to determine the destiny of our black community." They also called for full employment of the black community, restitution for slavery, decent housing and education, exemption from military service, and an end to police brutality, among other demands. Nearly 50 years later, the issues the party championed remained relevant today. What can we learn from the legacies of the Black Panther Party? A new documentary about the party is called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, and it opens in Bay Area theaters tomorrow. It opens at the Landmark Opera Plaza in San Francisco, Landmark Shattuck in Berkeley, Landmark Piedmont in Oakland, and the Christopher Smith Raphael Center in San Rafael. And joining us to talk about the new film is Stanley Nelson. This is Stanley's 8th film to premiere at the Sundance Film Festival. Stanley is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, MacArthur Genius Fellow, and he was awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Obama. Stanley Nelson has directed and produced a number of films, including Freedom Summer, Freedom Riders Jonestown, The Life and Death of the People's Temple, and The Murder of Emmett Till. And Stanley Nelson joins me in studio. Hi, Stanley. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. And we are also joined by former Black Panther Steve McCutcheon. Steve was a math and physical education teacher at the Oakland Community School of the Black Panther Party. He was also the chief instructor for the Oakland Community Learning Center's martial arts program. And Steve McCutcheon joins us on the line from Oakland. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, everybody. How you doing?
Good morning. Well, it's great to have you. So, Stanley, it was so interesting watching your film as the Black Lives Matter movement is going so strong and forcing so many people to really talk about racial injustice. In fact, Senator Elizabeth Warren gave a speech a couple of days ago about racial injustice, and she's using language from the Black Lives Matter movement.
Really, that's amazing. You know, when we started making this film about 7 years ago, you know, I thought that it was pertinent. I thought that, the issues of police brutality and other issues that the Panthers raised were pertinent 7 years ago. But obviously, it's become much more pertinent and much more upfront, you know, with what's happening today. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, so 7 years ago, and what I love about the film is it weaves archival footage with interviews you did with so many former Panther members. And in fact, 5 former Panthers have passed since you interviewed them, and we'll talk about that today. But what was it like for you to make this film as all this movement has been exploding, and we're getting videos and, you know, so much talk now about police brutality?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's happened in the last year and a half really exploded as we were in the final stages of editing the film. And so, you know, we're just in the editing room kind of amazed at all these things are happening that apply so much to the film. You know, it's this weird coincidence, but I think one thing it's done is it's kind of opened a window onto the film. It's made the film more accessible to people who might have, you know, a year ago might have really discounted the Panthers and said, oh, those were just some guys and women with guns. But now, you know, the problems of police brutality are right out front, and people, I think, it makes the film, again, more accessible for people.
Steve, what were your thoughts when you first saw the film?
As I spoke to one of your personnel yesterday, I will not see the movie until Saturday. But I have spoken to many of my comrades who have seen the first premiere that showed here in May. And from what we are gathering right now, we understand that the police institution has always been a problem that affected the black and poor communities. And we are seeing that reformed today and being put more in place today. So the issue of police brutality is not one that's resurfacing. It's one that has always been a continuing process and a continuing problem in the black and poor communities.
And what was it like for you, Stanley, when you interviewed so many former Panthers and talked to them about what's happening today? I mean, what affected you the most about how they were reflecting?
I think that you know, you have to understand that I was 15 when the Panthers came into being in 1966. I was in New York City. You know, I was kind of the target audience for the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had always been fascinated by the Panthers. And so the chance to get to sit down and talk to people one-on-one about their experiences in the Panthers was just amazing for me. You know, and then to try to cut it down and make it into a film was another task.
In the film, a lot of people talk about the fact that the bulk of the Black Panthers were actually teenagers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that you know, people don't understand enough, is that the Panthers were really, really young. A couple of the leadership, you know, Huey and Bobby and Eldridge, were a little bit older, you know, in their 20s. But the majority of Panthers were, I think the average age was like 19. You know, these were teenagers.
And a lot of people across the country, and I believe including you, Steve, learned about the Black Panthers when they made national news. They showed up at the Sacramento legislature armed and with demands for black liberation. Is that when you first learned about the Panthers, Steve?
Yes, that's correct. When the members of the Black Panther Party, led by Bobby Seale, Bobby Hutton, and Emory Douglas, and other brothers and sisters, went to the Capitol to introduce Huey P. Newton's executive mandate number one. It was flashed across the country, and I happened to be watching the news in Baltimore. And I saw the incident and the confrontations there, and that piqued my interest because at that time I had been following Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown. But this armed, organized group of men and women caught my interest, and I wanted to see if I could follow up and see what their activities and message was about.
And so what were your thoughts when you learned more about it? I mean, just to let people know, and if you remember this, we'd love to hear from you, but, you know, here were a bunch of guys in their black jackets armed, and Ronald Reagan was giving a press conference, and then all of a sudden, these guys showed up, and all of the media just flocked to the Panthers.
Later, that was what I was told, and that is the message that was conveyed by those who did participate in that event. But it was not until 1968 that I had the opportunity to meet members who were organizing in Baltimore as part of that original cadre. And then I was able to purchase a newspaper. I was invited to the political education classes of that newly organizing body, and found that there was more to the Black Panther Party than what the news clip indicated on that particular day.
Stanley, you've got amazing archival footage of the media, the newspaper, and people you interviewed said that we reached people we'd never see. I mean, they were handing newspapers to people while they were driving in their cars, and then the first thing in the paper was the 10-point platform. So talk about the power of that newspaper.
Yeah, one of the things we really wanted to highlight was the paper, and some of that, I think, comes out of my memory and so many of the memories, like Steve just said, that the paper was in some ways the first contact point for the Panthers. That's where you kind of learned about the Panthers, because they were out in the black communities in all major cities on the street corners selling the paper. And if you didn't buy one, your friends had one, or your brother had one, or somebody had one, and you got to see the paper, and that's where you got to see kind of the unfiltered Panthers without the influence of a newscaster telling you what to think. So the paper was really, really, really important to the Black Panthers and to the spread of the Panthers. The papers, one of the things in the paper every week was the 10-point program, which was the basis of the Panther movement, where the 10 points that the Panthers wanted, and it is, you know, what we want, what we believe, and then there were 10 points.
You also have amazing footage of the illustrations by Emory Douglas. I really loved that, because everything was, so colorful and it's moving in the film.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, Emory Douglas was the kind of artist of the Black Panthers. You know, he became a world-famous artist. artist. He kind of took some of the influences of Cuban revolutionary art and Chinese revolutionary art and made his own art. And you know, it was something that you bought the paper to see, you know, Emery's art, because they were beautiful. A lot of them were made into posters, and they were hanging all over the communities. He was very, very influential. But he also was able to, you know, say some things in the art that were very startling that you didn't normally see out there in the world.
Emery also talked about, and this is archival footage, Huey Newton asked Emery to draw a cop as a pig.
Right.
Is that where this originated?
I don't think that it exactly originated from, you know, that. I mean, I think that it's where it spread. And what Emery did was he took the pig drawing and then stood it up on two legs and then, you know, put the cop uniform on it and flies flying around it. And every week he would have these cartoons, you know, with the pig, as you know, it came to be called. He'd have the pig, you know, doing different things. And again, we have this great scene in the film where you see different groups, you know, yelling "off the pig" or "pig, pig, pig," and you know, and it goes from Panthers to, you know, college students, black college students, white college students. You know, everybody at that point is calling the police the pigs.
You also interviewed former LAPD about this.
Yeah, and they're pretty funny about that. One guy says, you know, he didn't really mind when the Panthers called him pigs. He expected that. But when college students started calling him pig, that's what really irked him. Oh. And another one tells a great story, which I will not give away,
yeah,
about a little girl in the black community and calling him a pig.
Stanley Nelson is a filmmaker. His latest film is The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It opens tomorrow in the Bay Area. And we're also joined today by former Black Panther Party member Steve McCutcheon. He was a math and physical education teacher at the Oakland Community School of the Black Panther Party. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the relevancy of the Black Panther Party today? What do you remember about the Black Panther Party? It started locally in West Oakland. If you were a member, or if you had friends who were members, if you were affected by the party, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Stanley, because there are so many films about the Panthers, so many books, I mean, there's a book just about Emery and the work that he did, the amazing illustrations. What were you hoping to accomplish by putting out another documentary about the Black Panthers?
Well, you know, when I was making the film, people would always say, well, there's so many films about the Black Panthers. And I'd say, okay, well, which ones are those? Because I'm not sure which films those are. I think the Panthers, you know, figure in other films, or there are films about individual Panthers. But I felt there wasn't really a film about kind of the rise and fall of the Black Panther Party and trying to pull all of that information together and tell the story. You know, of course, we can't tell the whole story of something that happened over, you know, 10, 15 years. But I think that we do a pretty good job of pulling the story together.
Steve, what are your thoughts? What do you think are, you know, the stories that still need to be told?
For one, the early days of the Black Panther Party, or people may wrongly refer to those as the golden years of the party, those are things that highlight and bring the attention of the unaware community to the Black Panther Party. But the later years of the party, what we did after we consolidated branches and chapters and members of the party here in Oakland, California, that story needs to be told, and more importantly, it needs to be highlighted, because this is where our community survival programs were entrenched and flourished and drew the support that eventually led to our entry into the political arenas, and also entrenched our programs and projects as institutions in other black communities. That is part of the history and legacy of the party, which has very little light has been shed upon. But those stories there from the general membership of the party needs to be told, because we were among the people who went into the communities, who provided those programs and touched bases and affected people, and were affected by people that we had to see every day. Those are the stories that need to be told, because the community survival programs were the lifeblood of the party, and that was the basis of our support.
You're talking about the free clinics, the free breakfast programs, really making connections within the Black community?
Yes, they did more than that. Those programs provided the services and needs that the Black community could not afford from traditional institutions. The party provided these because we recognized there was a need. The concepts of free health care, the concepts of education that provided for the foundation and true history of people, the foundations for truth and justice in the justice system. All of those were part of the framework and the ideas and concepts of our 10-point program and platform. Those ideas were put into practice through our community survival programs, which became more relevant and more visible when members of the party started consolidating here in Oakland during the early 1970s.
And again, you were involved in the Baltimore chapter, and you know, a lot of the Panthers said every city, large and small, wanted a chapter. So what was that chapter like?
In Baltimore, Baltimore at that time was predominantly Black, and basically the same problems and conditions that existed in Baltimore, Oakland, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., across the country, across the urban areas of our country existed in Baltimore. And there were some of us who came together after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King and Senator Robert Kennedy, and this is what led to the formation of the chapter in Baltimore during those early days. And the example that had spread from here in Oakland back through the Midwest and the East Coast eventually led to Baltimore organizing the, a chapter there in Baltimore and becoming a part of the family of the Black Panther Party.
Steve McCutcheon is a former member of the Black Panther Party. He started the party chapter in Baltimore and then relocated to Oakland. And Stanley Nelson is a filmmaker. His latest film is The Black Panthers, Vanguard.
Just one correction.
Oh, sorry.
I did not start the party. I was one of the early members of the Baltimore chapter of the Black Panther Party.
Okay, thank you. And Stanley Nelson is a filmmaker. His new film is The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, and it opens in Bay Area theaters tomorrow. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jerry in Emeryville. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I'm enjoying the program. Thank you. I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm just wondering if the filmmaker included the influence of Malcolm X on Huey and Bobby, because I was at Oakland City during the time they were there, and I was in the Nation of Islam. And I know Huey and Bobby both told me that they got the 10-point program, what we want and what we believe, from the back of the Muhammad Speaks newspaper at that time. And I was just wondering if he included Malcolm X's influence, and to just note that Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam are still very relevant today. On 10-10-15, Minister Farrakhan is calling for a 20-year recognition of the Million Man March, and he's calling for all Black people, all Black men, to go to Washington, D.C. to call for justice or else for all the police brutality and all the wrongs that have happened to our community over the past 400 years.
All right. Thank you, Jerry.
We do touch a bit on Malcolm X and what else is happening at that time and before that. But we don't spend a lot of time on it. You know, one of the things that I found as a filmmaker is very hard to do is to kind of give too much of a backstory to any story that you're telling. You know, I did a film called Freedom Riders, and we really wanted to include a lot about Mahatma Gandhi and how Gandhi influenced the whole nonviolent civil rights movement. But once we got into production, it was like, okay, we got to get to the story. We got to get to the story, and unfortunately, we cut that out. So it's the same here. You know, we really had wanted to go into Malcolm X a little more. We wanted to go into the Black Panther Party of Lowndes County, where they got the image from down south. But we just couldn't fit everything in.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Jerry. Let's go next to Esmeralda in San Francisco. Hi, Esmeralda.
Hi. Thank you so much. I can hardly wait to see the movie. I also was 16 when the Black Panthers started, and I was a teenage runaway in Haight-Ashbury. On that whole tip, there were two different worlds, Oakland political, San Francisco kind of spiritually based. But I think it's really important to remind people that the 60s took, I mean, the fact that the Panthers could show up at a Reagan alley, show up like near him, fully armed, could never happen again. And the 60s really took the whole right by complete surprise, the whole established world. It was the last generation, our generation, the Panthers' generation, was the last education of really well-educated public school people. We were very well-educated, and it really blew everybody's minds of how politically organized a group like this could be. The thing that blew my mind the most, and I wanted to ask you if you included it in the film, was when, to me, the most shocking thing was when they blew up a house of Black Panthers in Los Angeles without evacuating the neighborhood and just annihilated everybody. Did you add that in the movie?
I'm not exactly sure of what incident you're talking about. We do have a huge section in the film about the raid in L.A. on the Panther headquarters.
I think that's what she's talking about.
Yeah.
So they didn't evacuate.
So they did the raid, but
public.
didn't let the people in the neighborhood know that this was happening.
Oh, no, right. No, they didn't let anybody know. It's an incredible scene. One of the things that the Panthers did was, because Fred Hampton, the leader in Chicago, had been killed 4 days earlier, the Panthers put sandbags around the walls because they thought something was going to happen. So what happens is the SWAT team, this is the first SWAT team in the United States, and this is their first no-knock raid. They raid the Panther office, but they can't get in because the whole place is sandbagged, and it gets into this incredible shootout that goes on for over 5 hours. And what that does is it allows the news cameras to get there. So the whole thing is on film. And in the film, we have officers who were shooting in from outside, but also Panthers who were trapped inside and are shooting out from inside. It's a very, very dramatic scene.
And I understand that two of the men who survived that raid were in the film, and they have since passed.
Yeah, Wayne Farr and Ronald Freeman are in the film talking about what happened to them. That's probably my favorite scene in the film. It's one of the best scenes in the film. Mm-hmm. And they both passed away, since we did the interviews, less than 2 years ago from natural causes.
Steve, just briefly before break, you wanted to jump in there?
Yes. The event in L.A., the raid on the L.A. office was December the 8th, 1969. And message went out to all chapters of the party to be on heightened alert after the murder of Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton in Chicago. And because the L.A. chapter, the Southern California chapter, had always been prepared for the attacks of the police there in the area, they just made further preparations and heightened their office and housing security in preparation for an attack from the LAPD.
And hold that thought, Steve. We're going to take a quick break. Today on Your Call, we are talking about the new documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It opens in the Bay Area tomorrow, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
Thank you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about a new documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It opens in Bay Area theaters tomorrow, the Landmark Opera Plaza in San Francisco, Landmark Shattuck in Berkeley, Landmark Piedmont in Oakland, and the Christopher B. Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael. You can get more information about the openings at yourcallradio.org. And today, I'm joined by Stanley Nelson. He will be at screenings throughout the weekend, joined by former Black Panther Party members, with Emery Douglas. He'll be at the San Francisco opening tomorrow at 7 at the Landmark Opera Plaza. You can also catch Stanley and Steve McCutcheon on Saturday at the Piedmont Theater in Oakland and Sunday at Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley with Panthers Erica Huggins and Marvin X. And you can find that information again at yourcallradio.org. Stanley Nelson is a filmmaker. He's made a number of films about such a wide range of really interesting topics. You can find more information about his films at yourcallradio.org. And Steve McCutcheon is a former Black Panther. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And Steve, you were talking about how the Panthers were preparing for more raids after the killing of Fred Hampton. And let's talk about Fred Hampton, Stanley, because Fred doesn't get as much attention as Bobby Seale and Huey Newton. And he was a member of the NAACP at a very young age. And then he joined the Panthers at, was he 17?
I'm not sure what how
really
old
young.
He was, but he was 20 when he kind of became deputy leader in for the Illinois chapter in Chicago.
And he brought a lot of people together and brought people into the Panthers because he was such a dynamic speaker.
Yeah, I mean, Fred Hampton was an incredible speaker, a very charismatic guy. But the main thing that he was doing in Chicago that was a little bit different was he was really forming these unions with other groups. He was really working with Latino gangs. He was working with what they actually call hillbillies in Chicago. That's what they call them. But these are poor whites who came down from Appalachia to work in Chicago. And he's making inroads. And they were, you know, forming this kind of unity group. And they called themselves the Rainbow Coalition.
Talk about how that was received, because we learned from COINTELPRO and J. Edgar Hoover that this was a massive threat to the state when you bring Black, brown, and white people together.
Well, according to J. Edgar Hoover, it was, I think, you know.
Right.
I mean, that's something we haven't talked about, that you know, the Panthers early on come into the sights of J. Edgar Hoover. And once Nixon is elected in 68 and takes office in the beginning of 69, you know, Nixon really gives J. Edgar Hoover free rein to do whatever he wants. And he goes after the Panthers, you know, with everything he can. He calls the Panthers the greatest internal threat to the security of America. And you know, so what that did was not only focus the FBI on the Panthers, but also focus local police. Because they're saying, okay, if the head of the FBI says this is the greatest internal threat, well, then it must be. And then we have to get rid of them. And it really brings, you know, a lot of heat down on the Panthers.
Steve, can you talk about the power of what Fred Hampton did, bringing such a broad-based coalition of people together? You know, talking to white people, saying, hey, we've got your back. We know that you're suffering from poverty, and so are we.
Oh, wow, yes. Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton. One thing he did, he and members of the party there in Chicago, they were able to reach the Young Lords, which was a Puerto Rican street gang, and the Young Patriots, and the, which were an Appalachian street gang, and got them politically motivated in terms of addressing the needs of their communities. So the Young Lords became the Young Lords Party, and the Patriots became the Patriot Party in Chicago. And he was also Fred, Deputy Minister Bobby Rush, who is now Congressman Bobby Rush. They were able, along with the other membership in Chicago, they were able to reach the Black Peystone Rangers gang then. And they were able to get them to look towards the community in terms of meeting the needs of the people that had been afraid of them. And by bringing them together, this brought these groups together so that at that point they became this coalition there, this broad-based coalition that reached a Chicago and sent that message to agencies, the police and political agencies, that there could be a unity in the community. This is what frightened the power structures in Chicago and even further antagonized J. Edgar Hoover at the Justice Department under Mitchell and Nixon at that point. And it also broadened the scope and the depth of the Black Panther Party.
You know, and it's so interesting when you think about Martin Luther King really taking on poverty and, you know, talking about internal battle, should we deal with this issue? And I was telling Stanley earlier that we've been doing this series on police violence and race and the community, and we've had on such a wide range of people, former prisoners, Black Lives Matter activists, police officers, and almost every single person says, yes, racism, we have to talk about that. He said they have said, women and men, but we also need to address poverty. That's the other theme that has come up in all of these shows, that we really need to address poverty.
Yeah, that's actually one of the points that the Panthers in Chicago made. You know, they say to the young Patriots, which were the white gang, they say, you know, poverty is something that we all have in common. We have to fight it. And I think one of the things that Fred Hampton was talking about and the Chicago Panthers were talking about was this was really a class war. You know, it was about class. It's not about race. And so I think that also made him a threat in J. Edgar Hoover's mind. And what's interesting is with J. Edgar Hoover is why, you know, and I think why is because J. Edgar Hoover thought that his mission was to keep things as they were or as he saw them to be, you know, somewhere in, you know, like 1915 when he was a kid, when he was growing up. I think that's what J. Edgar Hoover thought his mission was and the FBI's mission.
We'll talk more about that in a minute, but Steve, what are your thoughts about the importance of addressing poverty, and what do you think about the role that it plays today, for example, with Black Lives Matter?
The question of poverty has always been there. It's inbred in the economic and social system under which we live. It's due to class division and racial divides. Again, based on the type of structures that are in place among the different groups of people here in America. So that conflict between levels of wealth or levels of people being disenfranchised is inherent in the system. The party addressed that as best as we could through providing for the immediate needs of people. One of the guiding ideas of the party was that people need not need. And in a wealthy country, which claims to be the wealthiest in the world, people should need not need. And we tried to address that through the community survival programs in the absence of other institutions which did not address the needs of people who were unemployed or underemployed.
Steve McCutcheon is a former member of the Black Panther Party. He was a math and physical education teacher at the Oakland Community School of the Black Panther Party. Stanley Nelson is a filmmaker. His latest film is The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It opens in the Bay Area tomorrow. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Stanley will be appearing at a number of screenings with former members of the Black Panthers, including Steve McCutcheon. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question or a comment for Steve and Stanley, we'd love to hear from you. What do you remember about the Black Panthers? And what are your thoughts about the message 50 years ago? It's still so relevant today. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jackie in San Francisco. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Hello, everybody. I am very grateful to the Black Panthers, particularly their paper. I was in the first group of 8 students admitted to Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the time the paper came out. And I remember their article on sickle cell anemia. I had went to elementary school with 2 students that was affected by that. They would be sick in the class, and the teacher would send them down to the office, and she would apologize and tell us that they were suffering from sickle cell anemia. And on the way home from school, I would be saying, what is that? What is that? And I would ask my friends, and no one seemed to know. And then I read about it in the paper because the scientists in our country was not doing anything about it. And one thing I don't hear, it was after the articles came out in the paper that, you know, the medical community should look into this. Something was eventually done with sickle cell anemia. And another thing I appreciated about the paper was I learned the power of corporations. Angela Davis contributed a paper. Being that I was in this supposedly elite group admitted to Temple University, I was able to get a better sense of myself. I am 77 years old, very well educated, and I am grateful for that paper. Have a good day, everybody.
One thing I just want to add, you know, for viewers too, I mean listeners, is that, you know, papers were really, really important back then, and it's hard to understand if you weren't around. You know, there were three networks. There was ABC, NBC, and CBS, and you might have one local station on TV. That's how you got your news. And then there were the newspapers, the mainstream papers. And so that's how you got the news. There was no internet. There was nothing like that. So papers were really important, and the Panther paper was extremely important because it was a different angle on the news, and we weren't getting that from anywhere else.
Well, Jackie, thank you for calling and sharing that great story, and I hope you can see the film because there's really amazing footage in here about the paper and the effect that it had on such a wide range of communities. So thank you so much for calling in. We have an email from Marilyn, and she says, I love that the Panthers are back. Has the U.S. come full cycle from the racial and reproductive justice movements of the 70s? I was involved in both Kansas City, Missouri in the 70s. After MLK and Bobby Kennedy's assassinations in 1968, the Panthers appeared in Kansas City with a coaches' council. All the city's coaches volunteered time after school on weekends at the African-American high schools. They were still segregated. I was involved at Planned Parenthood, which was under attack, and we connected with the Panthers. The civil rights and reproductive rights movements merged. How ironic that we are back now defending both again.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we have to understand, and I think Steve made this point, you know, earlier on, is that, you know, it's not that, you know, things got better and then they got worse. I mean, those problems were never solved. You know, it's like this open wound that never got healed. And so that's why we're in the position that we are today. You know, police brutality was with us before the Panthers. It was with us after the Panthers, and it's here. It's with us today. I think, you know, if any good can come out of what's happened in the last year or so, it's that it's shown a light on police brutality, and we're talking about it in a way that we haven't since the Panthers.
What strikes you, Stanley, about the conversation that you're hearing among young movements today? Because I know that when you screen this, you're on stage sometimes with former Panther members and then Black Lives Matter activists.
I think the most startling thing to me, you know, that's happened with showing the Panthers is, you know, I made a film, Freedom Summer, that came out about a year and a half ago. And when we screened that film, you know, people would get up in the audience and complain about youth today. You know, young people aren't involved. They're so apathetic. Young people, all those young people. You know, that doesn't happen today at all. Nobody ever gets up and says young people are apathetic. That's how much things have changed in a year, because there are so many young people who are involved and so prominently involved. I just think, you know, it's everything has changed in 1 year. It's just amazing to see. We screened the film in Philadelphia, you know, and I look up and the escalator is coming down to the theater, and there's 75 African-American students from Penn who had, you know, bought 75 tickets in a block and come, you know, are coming to the film all at once. It's just amazing to see. So, you know, there's great discussions about the Panthers. You know, what are the lessons from the Panthers, both good and bad, to the movement today?
Steve, what are your thoughts on that?
One thing we have to look at is that, first of all, the things that happened with the party and in our communities, we are all interconnected. Because people are not aware of issues of police brutality, or they have not been exposed to issues of police brutality, each of those issues, however distant they are, still affect each and every one of us. We are still tied together as a social network, and anything that does not tie us together with a belief of disconnection is a fallacy. It's both a logical fallacy and a social fallacy. So what the activities of one group and organization with youth participating more today, or apparently participating more, just shows that these problems here were never addressed. They are being reacted to as they become more promoted more through the media, and members of the community become more sensitive to those events due to the increasing numbers and recognition of the continuing issues, which have never been addressed, but the administration and agencies have only made concessions to.
We have an email from Lisa who says, today there's a bit of a difference of political opinion between older black Marxists and the new Black Lives Matter activists over class, with the former arguing that class is not given enough attention when dealing with police and state violence. What do you think about that, and was that an issue back then, too?
I lost who was who in that argument, but you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that separates this country and makes it work is the fact that, you know, racism is thrown into the mix. So, you know, you can't talk about class because there's this specter of racism, over everything. So I think that a lot of times it's hard, you know, which one do you talk about first? How do you deal with it? And I think, you know, that's always been the issue. That's the issue today, and in some ways that's the issue, you know, with the Panthers. But I think they were very clear on, you know, their statement, you know, of black power to black people, white power to white people, yellow power to yellow people, brown power to brown people. What the Panthers said is, you know, no, we want to work with white people, but, you know, white people, you go work with your own community, you know, Asian people, you go work with your own community, and we'll work with ours, and then we can all come together. But there's work to be done in every community, and you know, you're better off working in your own community.
Steve, what would you add?
Yes, I'll concur with Stanley that race and class are both issues, but they are opposite sides of the same coin. And that in this particular society in which we live, we see there are class divisions, again, based on the economic status of each individual, and they're even further divided because of the racial separation. And institutions have made these differences apparent and obvious to people, and people through generations have continued to harp on these differences, which further exacerbate the conditions that push people apart instead of bringing people together. Ideas need to bring the people together. Ideas and activities need to bring the people together on common ground around the issues which they each suffer, and this is what's being avoided and being watered down by too much of the media and too much of the agencies. They do not take into account that because of the class differences and because of racial and ethnic differences, those separations have become a part of the mental construct and the physical behavior of people in our different communities and throughout this society.
Well, thank you for sending in the email, Lisa. And let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Jim in Oakland. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to say I think apathy is still a problem, but there are great exceptions to it, and I think it's still something that we're all contending with as progressives in this country, unfortunately. But my question also is, so it seems like now with Black Lives Matter and emphasis on police wearing cameras and people using video to monitor police brutality, it's maybe slowing it. It seems like obviously police violence and impunity are still a huge problem. But I'm just wondering if the cameras are sort of a descendant of the Panthers, you know, observing police while carrying guns. It seems kind of similar, but almost downgraded. But it's more popular now, and I'm just curious if there's a connection there. So just curious about your caller's comments on that, seeing the relation between carrying guns to observe police or carrying cameras now and hope for increased effectiveness.
You know, one of the things that's come out in different screenings of the film is that, you know, people have said that the camera is kind of the new gun, and it's being used as a weapon to shine a light on police violence. I think that, you know, when we screen the film, and we've had Panthers all over the country at different screenings, you know, every Panther always says, you know, this is a new day, it's a new movement. We're not saying, you know, to go back to policing the police with guns, but we are saying that you know, the main thing is that people are involved and figure out how to help to rectify the problems of the police. So you can't just sit back and wait.
Steve, how do you see that?
On that point here, again, I'm going to go back to the point, the initial point, is that the problem with the police forces here in the United States doesn't lie with the individual officers. It lies in the culture of the institution, of the police institution, their mindset, their beliefs of how they treat safety and service conditions in the poor and oppressed communities. Those cultures have been, that culture, that attitude has been passed down generation to generation through the police departments, and that is what they bring into the black and brown communities in particular. That culture, that which gives them the authority to act as they feel their culture, their police culture, deems fit. And those conditions, which have led to acts of police brutality, the recent acts in particular, which have been highlighted, sure, they may have led to things such as body cameras and more oversight and overview, but again, the source of the problem is in the culture of the police institutions in the country itself.
Yeah, I just want to say, too, you know, one thing I think that is important is that, you know, the police are like a symptom of the problem. You know, if the police were the only problem that the black community had and Latino community had, we'd be in pretty good shape. We could solve that problem. But the police are a symptom of other problems, you know, housing, you know, poverty, mm-hmm. segregation. I mean, if you go to schools in any city in this country, they're still as segregated as they always were. If you go to, you know, housing, you know, you can go into a neighborhood, you don't have to see anybody. You could tell if it's a black neighborhood or a white neighborhood, you know, and it still is that way. It's either a black neighborhood or it's a white neighborhood, and that's how it is. So, you know, the police, yeah, that's a problem we have to solve, but they're a symptom. The police have traditionally been this buffer between the black community and the white community, and that's their historic role, you know, from slave catchers to you know, the brutality of the police, you know, in the 60s to the brutality of the police today.
Steve, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. Not only are they a symptom, but in our early days, of the Black Panther Party, we recognize that the police departments throughout the country, they were the first line of defense for for corporations and for politicians who made their livelihood by imposing a democracy on a dominant society, by allowing the dominant society to enjoy democracy, while at the same time the underrepresented, underserved, poor, and oppressed communities were the subject of basically forces that were there not to serve their needs, but they were there to occupy their community to make sure that properties were not damaged and that those citizens who conformed and were obedient and compliant to the status quo, their needs were met. So all of these things, the symptom, the police departments as a symptom, are a part and parcel of the police departments being no more than the armed representatives of the established dominant society.
Well, thank you for that email. We don't have, or phone call, we don't have time to take Irv, but Irv wanted to say he was a teacher at Woodrow Wilson in the 60s and thinks the Black Panthers had a huge effect on inspiring his students to focus on school. So thank you for that, Irv. We also have an email from Sharon about your presentation of COINTELPRO and also just the legacy that it left with the Panthers. So in addition to police departments across the country raiding offices of the Black Panthers. I mean, you had informants that they had to deal with, so much intimidation, the FBI pitting the party against itself, you know, so much of that. Do you think the public realizes just how strong that was?
No, I mean, I don't think the public realizes it at all. And I don't think, I mean, I didn't realize it when I went into making this film. I mean, I realized that, you know, the FBI had targeted the Panthers. But what I didn't realize is that, you know, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI had also documented it, had written it down. You know, there's memos that we used that we got from Freedom of Information Act that, you know, say we have to pit Eldridge Cleaver against Huey and Huey against Eldridge. Mm. We have to pit spouse against spouse, you know. And all these things were written down by the FBI. You know, in the film, as you say, we have former FBI agents and infiltrators to the Panthers and cops, you know, who talk about the role of COINTELPRO and the FBI in targeting the Panthers.
Steve, your thoughts on that just quickly before we have to end?
Yes, those external pressures instigated by the Justice Department and the, in particular, the works of the COINTELPRO did significant damage to the structure and organization membership of the Black Panther Party, which we did not even realize until the early 1970s when those documents became public. Once we realized that the COINTELPRO program was in effect, it helped us to understand why there have been problems at different chapters around the country, why Huey and Eldridge had their disagreement, why letters were being sent to Chief of Staff David Hilliard, why leadership in other chapters were receiving letters allegedly from supporters who talked about members being informers or provocateurs were being actually sent through FBI field offices at this time. This caused a lot of dissension and disunity among party members that was difficult to address.
Steve McCutcheon is a former member of the Black Panther Party, and Stanley Nelson is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker. His latest is The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It opens in the Bay Area tomorrow. Catch Stanley and Steve on Saturday at the Piedmont Theater in Oakland. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Steve, I'll see you Saturday.
Okay, will do. Oh, Stanley, I'll see you tonight.
And oh, okay, great.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, the war in Syria dominated discussions at the UN in New York, and Russia became the 13th country to bomb Syria. How are the media covering the role of outside forces in the Syrian civil war? We'll also discuss the Taliban's major attack on the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. We'll be joined by McClatchy's Jonathan Landay, the LA Times' Ali Latifi, and BuzzFeed's Borzu Daragahi. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.